Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. Pull it apart and weave the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Immigration has always been a contentious issue, but we used to be able to agree on reforms, see issues in our system, and work together to fix them. That era of bipartisan reform ended 40 years ago, and the odds of Republicans and Democrats today compromising on an issue like immigration? You'd have better odds playing the lottery. Ohio Senator Rob Portman even spent his career trying to broker a deal.
Somehow, I don't know, this issue just is one where there's a disconnect between the clearly broken system and what we're able to get together and do on a bipartisan basis.
And John Boehner, the Southwest Ohio congressman who became Speaker of the House, third in line to the presidency. He couldn't get it passed either, and trying to do so may have contributed to the loss of his speakership. We're talking about the politics of immigration this hour, but before we untangle how every modern deal in history fell apart, Leila Bilal says there's something she wants us to think about.
So it is something that's very near and dear to my heart. And again, I think anyone that tries to have a conversation with me around the politics associated with immigration, I don't even think I would really even care for a well-informed conversation because, again, to me, I just don't think you can politicize an issue that affects humans. And also the thing about refugees is it's not a choice to be a refugee. And I think that's a very convenient thing to forget. A lot of times it's, you know, not really a choice to immigrate.
Leila's own family didn't get a choice about immigrating to the United States when war broke out in her country, Bosnia, in 1992.
During 1992, the Serbian armed forces from Serbia, our neighbor to the north, decided to invade. And so essentially one day you maybe had a Serbian neighbor that you were drinking coffee with, and the next day, you know, your neighbor was joining arms against you.
Her father, who was in the military, died 6 months in. Then a grenade landed in the courtyard of their apartment complex.
And my sister said she was going downstairs, and my mom said, don't go outside. And so she went down and stayed in the doorway of that building. So when the grenade hit, the five people outside, four of them were killed, I mean, including a mother and like a two-year-old. And one of the other women who was there around my sister's age, she lost a leg. She's actually in the States right now as well. And because my sister was inside the building, you know, walls and doors protected her. But she still, you know, when the grenade hit and the shrapnel dispersed, it, you know, that's what injured her. But she, you know, could see enough at least to get up the stairs. And then we just, you know, she walked through the door and I just remember her saying like, Mama, which is mom in Bosnian. And then we looked at her and just all started screaming. Because you just couldn't, I mean, you couldn't even see facial features. It was all covered in blood. My mom just grabbed a sheet and covered her up because she was absolutely covered in blood. You know, her hair had been blown off and she had shrapnel all over her face. And just like that was like that image of my mom grabbing a sheet, wrapping her up and just leaving the building, you know, and you think about this, you know, you lose that sense of maybe safety in terms of, you know, should I really be going out right now when they are bombing the city? But she did and went out and found transit to a hospital.
Doctors stabilized her sister, and Leila's family was granted emergency medical refugee status, which meant they didn't have to wait in a camp or another country before getting to come to America. Leila knows they're lucky, not having to spend years or even decades in a camp like other refugees have. Which is why former President Donald Trump's travel ban hit her especially hard.
I also think about how easy it is for us because we are so unaffected by some of these issues that immigrants and refugees face, how easy and convenient it is for us to separate the human from the issue. And I think to me that that is, it's really an atrocity.
Tens of thousands of people are like Leila Bilal, waiting, sometimes in impossible circumstances, for their ticket to the United States. Those who don't want to wait abroad submit themselves at ports of entry, or attempt to cross the border without getting caught. Every president in modern history has said this system doesn't work. And yet, none of them have been able to do anything about it. Teresa Cardinal Brown is a senior advisor for immigration and border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. And for the last several decades, she's had a front row seat while those in power tried and failed and tried again. Welcome to All Sides, Teresa.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Anna.
So before we get to Ohio and John Boehner, I want to start with former President George Bush. The year is 2001, and President Bush decides that his first trip out of the country will be to Mexico. He talks about immigration reform during his first State of the Union, and by the end of summer, it looks like there might be a deal in the works. Can you tell us about a hearing that you attended in September?
Sure. So in September of 2001, I was working at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I was the director of immigration policy there. And the president of the U.S. Chamber at the time was a man named Tom Donohue. And he really believed that immigration was good for the country and could be good for the country. The chamber, of course, is seen as more, I think, of a Republican allied organization. And President George W. Bush came in, as you said, like looking to try to solve this knotty problem. So Tom Donohue reached out to Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, and also the leader of what was then the largest and still is the largest Latino civil rights organization, then called the National Council of La Raza, now Unidos US, who was Raul Izaguirre, and said, let's see if we can deal with this, right? We've been kind of on opposite sides of things. We need, you know, the president wants to do this. Let's see if we can do it. And they did. And this hearing in the Senate was sort of to be the very big kickoff where these three folks who represented sort of a large immigrant heavy population, the labor union movement, which had been, I would say, a little bit skeptical of the impact of immigrants on the labor force, and the pro-business U.S. chamber, who said immigrants are how we succeed economically, came together in the Senate all to say, yes, we think our immigration system should be reformed, and we think we can come to agreement on this. And it was a pretty profound moment. There was a lot of bipartisan, hey, this sounds great. Let's see what we can do. We'd already had some policy-related conversations with my colleagues in those other organizations about areas where we thought we could come to agreement. There was a lot of details to be worked out. There always were. But this was, I think, a big step forward. And then a few days later, the bottom fell out because this was September, the first week in September in 2001.
Yeah, and then 9/11 happens, and our government underwent a seismic shift. We created a new agency, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of Justice, you know, kept the immigration court system, but other immigration functions got brought into that newly created DHS. So everything essentially changed 1 week after you guys had this really historic agreement.
Yeah, it was you know, obviously a very tumultuous time. You know, in the first days after 9/11, none of us really knew what happened. But as sort of the investigations happened, and there was a commission, the 9/11 commission, that sort of examined how foreign nationals managed to come to the United States and plan this major attack, the immigration system was kind of front and center in this. And it was, you know, recognized that there were some big failures of the immigration system to detect that this was going on. There were limitations into how the immigrant agencies shared information or didn't with, for example, the intelligence agencies, who kind of had an idea that something was percolating. And so the creation of the Department of Homeland Security was one of the big outcomes of this. And it did fundamentally changed the immigration governmental apparatus. So previous to this, the Immigration and Naturalization Service was sort of the agency responsible for almost everything in the immigration policy space and the immigration law space. It was housed in the Department of Justice, along with the immigration courts, which were a separate piece of DOJ. But they also they had responsibility for deciding benefits on behalf of people who are applying for benefits in the United States, as well as enforcement. The Border Patrol was part of INS, the removal operations for deporting people, the attorneys that argued in immigration court for deporting people were all part of one agency. And the idea was that maybe these shouldn't all be together. Maybe we need to separate out sort of the enforcement side from the adjudication side. And so when DHS was created, INS was taken out of DOJ, and it was split into three agencies.
It got a whole lot more complicated.
It got a whole lot more complicated, right. So the three agencies were the border agency, which was Customs and Border Protection, merged the officers at ports of entry, who are immigration officers, with their customs counterparts from the customs department, customs agency, and the Border Patrol. They all went to Customs and Border Protection. The enforcement and removal operations went to Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And then U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services became the agency that adjudicated cases for applications for benefits, for visas, for travel, for green cards, etc. So one agency became three, but other pieces of the department of the immigration apparatus still remained in other departments. So Department of Justice retained the immigration courts, as you mentioned, and so they still had a role to play in immigration policy. We still had the State Department that issued visas overseas. That remained in the State Department. And for certain types of visas, the Labor Department is involved if you're trying to sponsor somebody for employment in the United States. And then, you know, we have this other office in the Department of Health and Human Services that manages refugee resettlement and unaccompanied children. So, you know, different cabinet departments, you know, dozens of agencies. It's become a lot more complicated to run the system.
Yeah. And then, you know, I think the American people as a whole, it made them a little skeptical because they were like, yeah, how did, you know, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals. And there was this fundamental question, how did they get here? Like, shouldn't we have known what they were up to and stopped them? So President Bush doesn't get back around to working on immigration until 2006. Obviously, we had the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He wins re-election, and then he decides, okay, let's circle back and see if there's any there. And this is when Senator John McCain gets involved. And it seems like they have a deal in the Senate. Things are going really well. And then somebody I didn't expect torpedoes it.
So this was the beginnings of what we now call comprehensive immigration reform, which was an idea that was germinated, I think, in the late 1990s. And the idea was that there's lots of pieces to the immigration system, but the fundamental interests are in our legal immigration system. What should it look like? How should it work? Who should we allow in to come as a permanent resident to the United States? Our enforcement system, mainly around the U.S.-Mexico border, because most undocumented or illegal immigration was happening at the U.S.-Mexico border by Mexican nationals. And then what do we do with the millions of people who have been living in the United States without status for many, many years? And of course, the last addressing of that was during President Reagan's tenure in 1986, when he granted amnesty to about 3.5 million undocumented immigrants. By the time President Bush got around to trying to work on comprehensive immigration reform, the numbers were around, I think, 8.5 million estimated. And Senator McCain reached out to a longtime champion of immigration, Senator Ted Kennedy. And this duo really shepherded a long series of negotiations among lots of different players. So the chamber was involved, the AFL-CIO was involved, another big immigration union, the SEIU was involved, lots of different immigrant rights organizations, interest groups, government agencies who have to adjudicate all of this stuff. I remember sitting in, you know, big conference rooms, Ted Kennedy's conference room, looking around at pictures of the Kennedy family with, 14 people and staffers from seven different Senate offices, and they brought in some House members as well who were trying to make sure this was bicameral as well as bipartisan, to work out these intricate details of this bill. At the end of the day, they came up with a product that almost everybody was okay with. And this is the thing about negotiating legislation. Nobody's going to go, oh, this is perfect, right? Everybody has to give and take, but everyone was okay with it. And for all of these different interests, they all felt there was enough in that that they could support it. So they went through the process, it went through the hearings, and it went through the markups in committee, and it got to the floor of the Senate. And the big pieces of this were legal immigration reform, created a big new temporary worker program for a lot of new immigrants, as well as additional green cards for family and employment-based immigrants. They were legalized over a period of time, a large number of the people who are undocumented in the United States. It did have resources and more efforts at securing the U.S.-Mexico border. So something in there for everyone. But the Senate floor is an interesting place. The rules of the Senate are pretty much whatever all the senators can agree upon. And so there was a lot of amendments flying back and forth. And even though almost everybody involved in the process felt this bill was good enough, there were people who wanted to see changes. And one of the biggest areas of, I think, not everybody being okay with it was the idea of this new temporary worker program. As I mentioned, the unions were still very concerned about particularly temporary workers. They felt that they had, because the temporary workers were beholden to the employers, they had more potential to undermine the U.S. workforce. And so they were not real happy about that program. And so one of the big amendments on the floor of the Senate was to take the temporary visa program out of the bill. And that amendment succeeded. And that meant that business really now had trouble looking at this and going, well, can we agree with this? And it kind of pulled the thing apart. And what was interesting about this, particularly when you fast forward a few years later, is that the key senator involved in that amendment was then Senator Barack Obama.
Yeah. So he pulls the worker visas, which basically crumbles the House of Cards.
It did. It did. And that was one of the challenges of negotiating such a big package in all of that minute detail before you submit it to the legislative process, is that it didn't, you know, something like that, you pull one thread and the whole thing kind of fell apart. And at the end, it wasn't able to succeed.
That was Teresa Cardinal Brown, a senior advisor for immigration and border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Coming up, we're talking tea parties, gangs of eight, and how John Boehner lost his job as House Speaker. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled, a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Stamer. Today is episode 3 in our series on immigration, and it's about the politics, the lawmakers, elections, and world events that have prevented us from passing comprehensive immigration reform. Still with me is Teresa Cardinal Brown, a senior advisor for immigration and border policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Teresa spent her career trying to help Congress get an immigration deal across the finish line. And earlier, we talked about all the reforms that flopped under President Bush. Now I'd like to move on to President Barack Obama. So Obama torpedoes immigration reform in like 2007, but then he becomes president and wins re-election in 2012. And that's critical because Latino and Hispanic voters were a core part of that coalition. They made up 10% of the electorate and broke for Obama over GOP nominee Mitt Romney by a 44-point margin. And Republicans really took notice. 2 days after the election, Ohio's own John Boehner told ABC News that reform was long overdue, and he was confident that it could, quote, take care of this issue once and for all. So, Teresa, that obviously didn't happen. But the deal got pretty far. Can you tell us about the Gang of Eight?
Sure. So Washington has this tendency, when things are big and complicated and hard to do, of a smaller number of members trying to get together and say, look, if we can agree on something, maybe we can then take it to the broader membership and then they can move it forward. And so this idea of gangs, usually bipartisan, of members who kind of take it upon themselves, sometimes with the blessing of their party's leadership, to see if they can work out some of these issues and move it forward. So in 2012, 2013, after the election, a gang of eight senators tried to do this. You know, obviously, Senator McCain was one of them, but Senator Kennedy was no longer around. Tried to kind of recreate what had been tried under President George W. Bush and come up with a new kind of vehicle. A lot of the same parameters. It was still comprehensive, dealing with the status of the undocumented, dealing with reforms to the legal immigration system. It also had a brand new temporary worker program. It had a few other things for the border, and you know, tried to see if they could get it through the Senate. And why the Senate? The Senate has fewer members, so you know, and
it has that 60-vote rule.
Yeah, it has fewer members. It only has 100 as opposed to 435 people in the House. It does require 60 votes to avoid what's called a filibuster. And what that mainly means is that anyone can kind of stop anything from moving unless you have 60 votes to keep it going. So it's got a higher threshold. But again, if you can get enough members, you can move things forward. And that was the hope. This bipartisan group with support from leadership could move this thing forward. There were conversations also happening in the House side, but it was sort of understood the Senate would move first. The theory being that if the Senate had a big vote, like well over 60, that would put pressure on the House to move something of their own. So the gang came out with their bill. It was called S-744 was the bill number. It had some long name. And the members shepherded it through the committees. But because it had been, again, so detailedly negotiated, not just among themselves, but a lot of outside groups as well, part of the process, going through the committee, they had to stand together to fend off amendments, because they saw what had happened before, that would pull this deal apart and make it harder to get through. They succeeded getting through the committee. They got it to the floor of the Senate. They had succeeded in fending off most of these amendments, but there were a bunch of Republicans who said, look, I could get on board, but we need more on the border. At the end of the day, two senators, Senator Corker and Senator Hoeven, came up, said, look, if we just put a lot more money into the border, I think we can get the votes we need on our side of the aisle. And so they did. Another amendment on the floor added, I think, $65 billion of border security. And that was enough to get the bill passed in the Senate with 68 votes. So over the 60-vote threshold, with a few to spare. And it was a really big moment. It was sort of the biggest vote on comprehensive immigration reform, on a big immigration bill, in many, many years. And then the hope was that it would go over to the House. And as you mentioned, John Boehner was Speaker of the House, and he was part of that sort of Republican relook at immigration and how Republicans were seen on immigration during the 2012 election, and was in favor of trying to move something at that time.
Yeah, and I will say that Ohio Senator Rob Portman was one of those Gang of Eight.
Was one of the gang.
He was
very
involved in negotiating. So, you know, he's working with Boehner, who's also part of his coalition. And so it gets to John Boehner, and I want to play a cut, actually two cuts of him back to back. So at the beginning, here's what John Boehner had to say about immigration.
Is immigration reform dead? Absolutely not. I've made clear going back to the day after the last election in 2012 that it was time for Congress to deal with this issue. I believe the Congress needs to deal with this issue.
But just a year later, Speaker Boehner said this.
All year long, I warned the president that by taking unilateral action on matters such as his health care law, or by threatening action repeatedly on immigration, he was making it impossible to build the trust necessary to work together. As I warned the president, you can't ask the elected representatives of the people to trust you to enforce the law if you're constantly demonstrating that you can't be trusted to enforce the law. The president never listened. And with this action, he's refused to listen to the American people. The president has taken actions that he himself has said are those of a king or an emperor, not an American president. And he's doing this at a time when Americans want nothing more than both parties to focus on solving the biggest problems in our country, starting with our still struggling economy. And the action by the president yesterday will only encourage more people to come here illegally.
So, Teresa, you know, Speaker John Boehner goes from, yeah, we're going to do a deal, to absolutely not. And he lays it at the feet of President Barack Obama, saying, you know, Obama realizes it's not going to pass. And he does this thing that now is standard for American presidents, which is try to fix immigration through an executive order. How did we go from we got a deal to we have an executive order?
Right. So I think we need to kind of back up a bit on President Barack Obama's tenure. So in his first term, you know, presidents, when they come into office, they have what they call it a certain level of political capital. And so most presidents will choose one big sort of issue policy area to work on in their first term, hopefully to get it done so they can run for re-election on this. And President Obama had said when he was running, he wanted to do immigration reform, but he also wanted to do healthcare reform. And it turned out that what he really did first term was healthcare reform. He passed the ACA and called Obamacare. And that was the big thing he put a lot of attention to. And he didn't really push hard on immigration reform. However, before the election in 2012, he did one executive action, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, which this week happens to be the 12th anniversary of DACA. And by doing so, he has said, I said before that I didn't think I had the authority, but now I do have the authority, and I'm going to try to protect and grant work authorization to this group of people. Fast forward a couple years later, and under a lot of pressure by a lot of immigration groups, including DACA recipients, to help their parents, he created another executive order similar to DACA called DAPA, which was Deferred Action for Parents of U.S. Citizens and DACA recipients. So big expansion. It also expanded the DACA population. This ended up in court, and the program never was launched, but that's what John Boehner was referring to. He said, look, we have a deal that if we can get this legislated, would deal with all of those folks, and you're moving ahead on your own. And this really did, I think there was always some, even though President Obama actually in the first 4 years he was in president, even though he was focusing his political energy in Congress on healthcare reform, he was actually doing a lot of enforcement. He was deporting a lot of people. He was enforcing the border. The arrivals at the border during his first term were some of the lowest that we had seen in decades. And he was deporting so many people that the head of National Council La Raza called him the deporter in chief. So the immigration folks by the second term were like, you owe us. You were doing all this harsh stuff. You owe us. And that's why they were pushing for this executive order, because they were somewhat doubtful of the legislative prospects. This represents a dynamic that has played out, I think, in the years since. The Republicans don't trust Democratic presidents to do the enforcement part of the comprehensive deal. I think Democrats and immigration advocates don't trust that Republicans are actually serious about getting to a deal that would legalize people. And so I think what you heard from Boehner in 2014, the breakdown of what was a real kind of high moment when this comprehensive bill passed the Senate, that breakdown of that deal in 2014, the distrust that kind of was existing there has only grown, I think, in the years since.
And that's, you know, it leads to this, what we see now, like former President Donald Trump and President Joe Biden have both issued executive orders, both, you know, are getting tangled up in courts. You know, Trump did the travel ban. Biden's trying to do this like border security policy now. And so it sort of seems like we've given up almost on bipartisan deals. And we are instead saying, well, I will go it alone. The courts will smack me down. And then, I don't know, we'll continue it with the status quo.
Yeah, there hasn't been, I think, a lot of bipartisan efforts at legal reform, particularly a big comprehensive bill. I think after the demise of the comprehensive bill in 2014 in the House, when John Boehner said it's basically dead, the idea that comprehensive was the way to go, that theory of the case, seemed to be gone. And so what you saw was maybe some attempts at smaller bills or smaller deals. So what comprehensive immigration reform, the centerpiece of that, that I believe, was really the legal changes to the legal immigration system. And on that hung sort of the legalization and the border pieces. But in the years since 2014, that legal immigration reform piece has kind of fallen out of the conversation. So if you ask a lot of people now what comprehensive immigration reform means, they believe it's a trade-off of border security for legalization. But the reality is that it's hard to merge those two things. Border security primarily is about incoming migration. How do we manage and control incoming, particularly irregular migration? And one way you could look at that is, yes, that's about enforcement, but it's also about how many people do you let in legally, right? Because that would be the trade-off. Meanwhile, when you're looking at the numbers of undocumented people in the United States, legalizing them, they're already here. Legalizing them helps them and helps them do better in the economy and for the United States. It helps them integrate, but it's not addressing what we call future flows. So those two things, even though that's the political trade-off, aren't necessarily the right policy levers because they're dealing with different populations and different priorities. But that's where the debate has been. And those also are the positions of the parties, respectively, that are their priorities. And as polling that we've done found, they're least likely to compromise on. So you're taking the two things that are the highest priority on immigration for each party, but they're least willing to compromise on, and hoping that by merging them together, somehow we can cut a deal. And it's never quite worked out that way. Either there's too much enforcement and not enough legalization, or too much legalization and not enough enforcement. It's about, you know, measuring those things. And the more enforcement you get, the more the legalization, people don't want to support that. And the more legalization you get, the more the enforcement, people don't want to support that. And it's just been too hard to come together. There have been different times. So during the Trump era, there was an attempt legislatively to create a permanent solution for DACA and Dreamers combined with border money. That didn't work out. There's been efforts we just saw last fall at another bipartisan piece of legislation that was mostly about asylum and the border and enforcement and didn't deal with the undocumented at all, which was a big, I think, fundamental turning point in the politics of the issue. It's the first time I think that you have seen bipartisan effort with the involvement of the White House on a piece of what was comprehensive immigration reform without another immigration piece trading off for that. It was really about getting Ukraine and Israel funding and not about other immigration pieces. So I think looking at where we are today, that goal of getting big, comprehensive, bipartisan legislation is almost further off than it ever has been.
That was Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
Coming up, whether we're going to have to wait for one-party rule before we see an immigration deal. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled, a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today is episode 3 in our series on immigration, and it's about Congress and why they haven't been able to agree on reforms in almost 40 years. James Massa is the CEO of Numbers USA, and he's been thinking about immigration for almost as long. He runs a nonprofit focused on lowering both legal and illegal immigration, and he joins us now. Welcome to Untangled.
My pleasure to be here.
So let's start with the latest attempt at immigration reform. Because the one that failed in the fall, or I guess early this year, may have set a record for the fastest failure ever. The group of senators spent 4 months negotiating the deal, and then it died in less than 4 days. So Senator Chris Coons of Delaware said that he's never seen a Mitch McConnell-backed deal collapse so quickly. What happened? It was like, we got it, we have it, and then we don't got it.
Well, I guess the it is part of the question. You know, it was intended to be something that was a bipartisan effort to come up with sensible immigration that met a lot of different requirements. And what actually came out was a bill that effectively raised immigration rather than reduced it. It allowed for an emergency act to secure the border, but allowed for and forced a number of immigration individuals to come across every day, like 1,400 every day. So it ended up being said to be one thing and actually something else. And when both parties saw it, it never even reached the point of going for a vote.
So you don't think Republicans walked away from a good deal?
No, the Republicans didn't walk away from a good deal, nor did Democrats walk away from a good deal. It wasn't a policy that any of the parties could really embrace. The most bipartisan thing about that effort was that it didn't reach what they call cloture, which is let's go ahead and have a vote on this particular bill.
So as someone who's covered state house politics for more than a decade, I know that policy is iterative. So I got to ask, what would be wrong with getting a little bit now, a little bit later, a little bit more down the line? Like, is that the way that we should be thinking about it rather than trying to build these big houses of cards that always seem to collapse?
Well, I think you raise a good point. And really, in order to understand that, you have to step all the way back to 1986 with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was a Reagan-era act, which was the first amnesty of over 3 million people that occurred. And at that same time, it set the foundation for things that are occurring today, like we have I-9s that we have in order to be able to have a job. And there's the H-2A program and the H-2B program, which is in all the alphabet soup having to do with agricultural temporary workers or non-agricultural temporary workers. There's a lot of things that went on there, but what occurred more than anything else was there was amnesty done immediately and enforcement was promised later, and it didn't come. And so ever since that time, voters have been telling their Congress people that they want to make sure that there's additional amnesties and additional immigration reform that the enforcement has to follow as well.
I think that's so indicative of where we are is that, you know, and what Teresa was talking about earlier is that there seems to be this lack of trust on both sides, that either side is going to fulfill their end of the deal.
I think that's true. And there's good reason to think that. I mean, since that amnesty that was supposed to be a one-time amnesty in 1986, there's been 6 additional amnesties. That particular amnesty was extended 4 times. There was an amnesty for Nicaraguans in 97. Amnesty for Haitians in 98. And actually, little people know this, but even Trump had a very small amnesty with Liberians of something like 19 people, but it was an amnesty nonetheless. And all these were done, again, without enforcement. So there's a repeated behavior that makes people cautious to be able to truly have immigration reform.
I want to move back in time to 2013, because after the 2012 election, it did seem like Republicans were seriously considering some kind of reform, including maybe a path to citizenship for Dreamers, those kids brought here illegally by their parents. And look, it could be really easy to say that the Tea Party tanked that deal, but I'm hoping you can give us some more perspective on why it got 68 votes in the Senate and then not a vote in the House.
Well, it's interesting. What actually occurred there, and just to give you the specific, that was the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act. It's
quite a mouthful.
A gang of eight. And because there were eight people who were supported. There were eight senators, four Republicans, four Democrats. You'd have thought it would have sailed through. And it really was on its way to sailing through with some of the things that you had talked about. But what occurred was the House Majority Leader, by the name of Eric Cantor, lost in the primary. And Dave Brat ran on strong immigration reform, specifically a stronger border. And so that shook everybody as to whether they really wanted to be behind this. And I think it came to a screeching halt, primarily because the people spoke in one election and said, no, they wanted something slightly different than what was coming through on that particular bill.
Yeah, I remember everyone was so surprised because there was this idea, at least back then, that incumbents, I mean, to an extent still today, incumbents tend to be pretty safe from challengers. And people were just shocked because Cantor was so high up in the Republican House that he, and to, you know, to be fair, I don't think that he took his challenger as seriously as maybe he should have, but I think everyone was just stunned that he lost.
Well, it is true. Because he was the House Majority Leader, which is, you know, the number one person other than the Speaker in the House for that party, you know, the Republican Party. And what I think you have to be aware of also is way back in 2006, Mitch McConnell was, you know, voting for, after 9/11, things like extending some fence to be built and some other things in around the southern border. And then 2007 and 2008 came along and he found himself having to vote against a immigration bill because his voters were calling out to him saying, hey, we don't want this. We don't want this. It was a very surprise, a big surprise called the McCain-Kennedy bill. And this Gang of Eight had a very similar piece. So when I think leaders like Mitch McConnell saw the same thing happening again with Gang of Eight that happened in the McCain-Kennedy, where the voters were saying, no, we don't want this, they backed off.
It's so funny that, you know, there seems to be this theory, and we talked about it earlier, that, you know, you get a small group together because this is so complicated. So you get a small group together, you work it all out, and then you get it through. But I don't know, insanity is supposed to be doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Is there insanity in Congress for thinking that we can try this and eventually we'll figure it out?
I actually think there is. You know, there are two comments. One is that one of the failures on the Senate effort that was made this year in 2024 was that they ignored the House effort that was made in 2023, something called H.R. 2, the Secure the Border Act. None of the provisions from that bill were included in what the Senate did. So the houses have to work together, and otherwise nothing's going to get done. I think the other lesson is, and maybe the hope is, that way back in 1924, Congress acted and they clamped down on immigration and basically got maybe the number right, but they were really discriminatory against the who of who was allowed to come into the United States. In the 1960s, there was a change in that, and they basically, 50 years later, changed it so that the right, you know, anyone from around the world could come in. It was no longer discriminatory, but the numbers went up dramatically. So we're hoping that the third time's a charm, and that this Congress or the 119th Congress can get it right and strike the right balance of the right number of people coming in and the ability to have the great diversity that we enjoy as our nation.
You know, I think it's easy to say that all these deals fell apart because of politics, because of one side or the other, or somebody did this or chose that, or people voted. But I don't think it quite gives us the whole picture, because in the last 20 years, who crosses our border has also fundamentally changed, from working age Mexican men coming over by themselves to families from across Central America and across the world seeking asylum. And the number of asylum seekers who present themselves at ports of entry has just exploded. So the who has changed.
The who has changed. Over 60% of the people crossing the southern border today are not from Latin America or South America. They're from all parts of the world. And there is a higher percentage of unaccompanied children as well as families. But part of that is the message that's being sent out from our nation to the rest of the world, saying either come one, come all, or certain laws that say if you come in as an unaccompanied child, for example, we have to take you in, and we have to take proper steps, you know, that you would think are reasonable. But what that does is it means that people then have their children coming across by themselves. And when we have the policy now where any family is taken in as a whole, as long as there's children there as well, then people come as family units. So it has changed, but it's changed somewhat because of how we process people here in the United States and what the messages we're saying to the rest of the world.
Next week, we're going to be untangling asylum as a whole because it deserves its own hour. But I will say the backlog of pending cases, so the people waiting to have their asylum case decided by a judge, has gone from 400,000 in 2013 to an estimated 3.1 million by 2023. So that line of people waiting to see a judge, I mean, it's just getting exponentially longer and longer and longer.
Oh, you're correct. And the thing about that that is probably most important, the thing that will affect that line more than having more judges, which is maybe needed, and maybe having more processing at the border, which may be needed, is where does that line stand? If you're going to stand in line inside the United States for the next 7 years with a work permit, that's not such a bad situation. If you have to stand at the border on in Mexico side of the border or in a third safe country where you came from, but you're safe and you could be employed there, that's going to dramatically cut down on the number of people who want to stand in that line. So the change in policy of saying, yes, you can apply for asylum, and that's allowed. But if you do so as a refugee, you should do that from the country you are in. And as an asylee, if you come into the nation and actually apply inside the nation, then you should go back to the nation you come from, or a safe third country, or the country that's contiguous to us, either Canada or Mexico, while we process your asylum claim. And if we did that, that line would get much, much, much shorter. And by the way, there's always going to be a line because there's nowhere better to live than the United States.
And because, I mean, unless we change the law on asylum, it does say if you have a credible fear of persecution in your home country, you can come and ask for asylum.
That is true. And, you know, to clarify, the persecution is for those things which we hold dear, like, you know, your religion, your color, your gender, those sorts of things. There are a lot of terrible places out in the world where there's gang activity, there's poverty, there's lack of economic opportunity. And those aren't actual persecutions. They're terrible situations, and ones that we, United States, needs to be able to reach out and try to help resolve and assist those people in those countries. But it isn't actually a persecution.
I also think the language around immigration is changing so much. You know, I've been listening to a lot of historical presidential speeches, and it just seems like the tenor has gotten like more divisive and uglier as the decades have gone on.
You know, both President Clinton and President Obama said very clearly in their inaugural addresses that we are a nation of immigrants and we are a nation of laws. And that balance has to be struck somewhere between what is occurring today and what was occurring way back in the Ellis Island era, when people kind of had this imagination that one, that immigration was wonderful and that everybody had such a pleasant experience. So I think we need to have immigration to continue to grow as a nation and to be able to have the diversity and benefits that come with it. But it has to be a limited amount of immigration. And we need to be able to ensure that we have a credible immigration system that says, hey, the people that are supposed to get in, the people who don't, aren't supposed to get in, do not. And then the real hard thing we're going to have to address sometime in the future is those who are here. What do we do with them? Do they go back, or do they stay here and have a path to naturalization?
That was James Massa, CEO of Numbers USA. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Next week, we'll be tackling the issue of asylum, but I'd like to end with former President George Bush speaking to the country about immigration reform and reminding all of us to keep in mind that there are humans behind the numbers. And as we continue to talk about who gets in and who gets out, we should probably all keep that in mind.
We will always be proud to welcome people like Guadalupe Danohan as fellow Americans. Our new immigrants are just what they've always been, people willing to risk everything for the dream of freedom. And America remains what she has always been, the great hope on the horizon, an open door to the future, a blessed and promised land. We honor the heritage of all who come here, no matter where they come from, because we trust in our country's genius for making us all Americans, one nation, under God. Thank you, and good night.
This is WOSU FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.